All right, there's a big story in the Washington Post today, a front page story written by Joby Warrick about the war in Iraq and the stories that we were being told in the lead up to and even after the war had started back in 2003. And the story really has to do with what we were told were biological labs on wheels, these big tractor trailers that had been found that supposedly were Saddam Hussein's labs being used to make biological weapons, part of the whole WMD argument. May 29th, 2003, 50 days after the fall of Baghdad, President Bush used these to declare to the American people, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction." That afternoon, I called Scott Ritter, the former UN weapons inspector, and asked him to come on my show and explain exactly what these trailers could be. Let me take you back to that day, and then we'll bring Scott on here live to talk a little bit more about that and the developments this week with Iran starting up that nuclear ladder. Here is Scott Ritter on the Paul Harris Show, May 29th, 2003.
Well, I only know what I've seen on TV or read about. What I will say is this: if you just go through the CIA's assessments and the assessments of the experts who have looked at this, keep in mind that they have found no biological agent, no evidence that these were ever used to produce biological agent, and no evidence that these were in fact designed to produce biological agent. What they're saying is, in looking at it, the only explanation they can come up with that makes any sense from a Western American point of view is that these were used to produce biological agent, but they themselves acknowledge that this was an extremely inefficient means of producing it. I mean, all you'd get, fact is, what would be produced in these laboratories, in the CIA's own admission, is not biological agent, but a slurry of biological goo that would require further steps of processing before it could ever, if ever, be used as an agent. You know, when you produce biological agent or any biological product that requires concentration, you start small, you concentrate, and then you sort of brew up. You go from a small container to a bigger container. Here, we have them starting with a big container. It makes no sense whatsoever. The Iraqis who built these laboratories are in our custody, and what they've said is that these have nothing to do with biological agent. These are hydrogen-generating devices to be used to fill balloons that are used in meteorological studies related to field artillery. And the scientists who have looked at this, the American scientists, said, yes, you could produce hydrogen there. You know, one of the byproducts of hydrogen production is aluminum, and what was found at the bottom of these containers were aluminum. So it appears that these have nothing to do with biological weapons, have everything to do with the production of hydrogen in support of legitimate military operations. But we are dismissive of this because we say, why would you put a hydrogen-generating device on the back of an expensive tractor trailer? We wouldn't do that in America, but guess what? We're not in America. We're in Iraq, a nation that has been subjected to 12 years of economic sanctions, and the Iraqis make do with what they have. These simply have nothing to do whatsoever with biological weapons.
That was Scott Ritter on my show May 29th, 2003, the same day that the president said, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction." Scott Ritter is back on my show this afternoon. I called him this morning and said, congratulations on once again being vindicated. But, Scott, I do want to ask you about one other thing that's in this Washington Post report, which says that this team that filed this report that is now just coming out was only one of three teams that actually went there in the spring and summer of 2003 and checked out these suspected mobile labs, and that two teams of military experts who viewed the trailer concluded that the facilities were weapons labs. So is this just a minority report that's only coming out now?
Well, you have to take a look at the composition of the so-called military teams. Are they teams of people who actually know what they're looking at, or are they ad hoc teams thrown together to do a rapid assessment? I look back on that time and recall seeing David Kaye, who later on headed up the CIA's own Iraq survey group, but back when he was simply a former weapons inspector working for NBC News, gained access to one of these trailers and had a live on national TV embarrassment for himself, where he walked through and pointed out each component and explained how you would produce biological agent. What an absurdity. We know that that wasn't what it was produced for, or that it can't do it. And yet David Kaye was on national TV, explaining how this could happen. Why? He's not an expert, but he was brought in because his resume sounded good. These military intelligence teams, keep in mind that there aren't people on active duty who have produced biological agent, and there's very few people who actually know how to do this. So what team did they put together? A bunch of intelligence analysts who don't know anything about the subject, who are predisposed to obey the chain of command's predilection to endorse this finding. I don't know. We need to see the team roster. We need to see what their resumes are. But during that period of time, we have team after team after team of so-called experts going in and passing judgment on things. Not just these biological labs, but a whole host of other devices, stockpiles, documents, and saying, hey, we have the smoking gun. This isn't the only case of the administration going wrong. So, you can call it a minority report because it was one group of people out of, three groups who took a look at the trailer, and theirs is the only one that was definitive in its rejection of the, of the trailers being associated. But is it really a minority report when the most qualified team rejects it, and in two teams who, it appears to me, are less qualified given endorsement? I don't think so.
All right, and it is important to point out that in September of 2004, 15 months after this report we're talking about was written, the survey group's final report said the trailers were, in fact, impractical for biological weapons production and were almost certainly intended for, as you said on my show in May of 2003, manufacturing hydrogen for weather balloons. Now, one other thing I want to ask you about in this Post report, and then we're going to talk about Iran just a little bit here. Let me read you a paragraph from this front page story in the Washington Post. Even before the trailers were seized in spring 2003, the mobile labs had achieved mythic stature. As early as the mid-1990s, weapons inspectors from the United Nations chased phantom mobile labs that were said to be mounted on trucks or rail cars, churning out tons of anthrax by night and moving to new locations by day. No such labs were found, but many officials believed the stories, thanks in large part to elaborate tales told by Iraqi defectors. Mid-1990s, you were on the job as the lead UN weapons inspector. Were you chasing these phantom mobile labs around Iraq?
The phantom mobile labs were actually initially a product of our own overactive imaginations. And as early as February 1992, I wrote a report saying, look, we're looking for material in Iraq that, based upon our survey of the physical sites that are on the ground, can't exist. And so if this unaccounted for material is out there being used for something nefarious, it would have to be mobile in nature. So we hypothesized a mobile capability. Then we said, if it is mobile, what would it look like? How would it be, how would the Iraqis do this? And so we came up with our own theories, of if the Iraqis are hiding something and it were mobile, what would it look like? And so the initial search for the phantom mobile labs were purely a product of our own imagination, trying to account for unaccounted for material by hypothesizing that it could be mobile in nature. Later on, there were Iraqi intelligence or Iraqi defectors who came through a variety of sources that spoke about mobile capabilities. But every time you parsed down that, their story, it fell apart rapidly. Around the mid-1990s, 1995, 1996, the UNSCOM biologists, the United Nations Weapons Inspectors biologists, again started, taking bits and pieces of unaccounted for components and production equipment and saying that theoretically you could bring them together and make some sort of mobile biological laboratory. But again, it was purely hypothetical. We asked the Iraqis questions about it. They denied ever having something like this. We did carry out a series of investigations to find out if this was feasible, but that's the extent of our involvement in looking for mobile biological weapons laboratories. For the most part, it was a hypothetical situation put together by inspectors in a effort to say, what could the Iraqis do if they were hiding material?
Gotcha. All right. Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector, and now going around the country speaking and writing, and told me this morning, I am happy to do your show again, but if the phone rings and I got to go, it means I got to go because you're a volunteer firefighter, right?
That's right. You're lucky because just shortly before you called, I just came back from two calls.
Oh, so, you did? Really?
We're in a little window of opportunity here.
Okay, good. I'm going to ask you to hold on, and hopefully no arsonists are at work right now. So let me take a commercial break. We'll come back, and then I want to talk to you about Iran and their claims this week about having produced low-grade enriched uranium at a level sufficient to power their nuclear plants and what that means as far as Washington and Tehran and the nuclear question. Stand by. Scott Ritter here on the Paul Harris Show. Back in a moment on News Talk 1120 KMOX. Talking again with Scott Ritter, the one-time UN weapons inspector in Iraq and expert on all of these things that are facing us from the Middle East now when it comes to weapons of mass destruction, which we didn't, of course, find in Iraq, but now could we be facing them in Iran? Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said today that the UN Security Council has to consider strong steps to induce Tehran to change course after yesterday their president confirmed that they have successfully produced low-grade enriched uranium at a level sufficient to power their nuclear plants. And he said, I officially announced that Iran has joined countries with nuclear technology. He says they're just for peaceful efforts and that no country should stand in their way. And then earlier today, Mohammad Saidi, who is the deputy nuclear chief of Iran, says we will expand uranium enrichment to industrial scale. Now, frankly, I don't understand what all this is about, so I'm going to ask Scott Ritter again to explain it to us. Is this the first step on the nuclear ladder for Iran, and how long is that ladder, Scott?
Well, it is definitely the first step. I mean, what the Iranians have done, and again, this is based solely upon their own statements, this week, International Atomic Energy Agency team of inspectors from the United Nations will be in Iran to basically go through what exactly the Iranians have accomplished, and the international community will be equipped with much more fact-filled data than we currently possess from the politicized statements of their leader. But let's keep in mind that what they've done is not against the law. The enrichment of uranium for peaceful purposes is permitted under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran is a signatory, and inspections that are permitted under this treaty are taking place. So there has been no violation of the law. So right off, people need to take a step back and take a deep breath and understand that we're not on the verge of global holocaust.
Okay, let me just stop you right there. The IAEA does have inspectors in Iran keeping an eye on this?
Absolutely. The only inspections that have stopped were inspections carried out in accordance with what was called the additional protocol, which was above and beyond that required by the treaty, which Iran had agreed to. But when the United States compelled the IAEA to transfer the Iranian case to the Security Council, the Iranians said, well, look, you guys aren't playing in good faith. An argument can be made that the Iranians aren't playing in good faith. But the Iranians said, because you've transferred to the Council these additional protocols, these no-notice inspections that we had let you done in the past, you're not going to get to do those. But all the inspections required by the treaty are still being carried out.
Okay. Now, explain to me what it means when they say that they have enriched uranium at 3.5%. What percentage do you need to make a nuclear weapon?
Well, first of all, you need around 20% to get your fuel, the fuel for a reactor functioning. So 3.5% is very low on the scale. To have to make a weapon, you need about 80-85%. Purity. 3.5% is extremely low. It's a product of the initial process. You take this gas called uranium hexafluoride. It gets inserted into a centrifuge. The centrifuge spins it up. When the gas goes in, it's basically at 0.7% of the uranium you need. And then the Iranians have created this cascade of 164 centrifuges that basically take this gas, spin it, concentrate 164 times. And at the end of that, out comes this product, which is 3.7% enriched uranium. It shows that the Iranians are capable of enriching uranium. But there's a catch here. What feedstock did they use? Because I'm going to bet you a dime to a dollar that they used uranium hexafluoride that was purchased from China, part of the 1,000 kilograms that they purchased in 1990s from China. The reason why I say this is that although Iran in the same statement said that they have now produced several tons of their own uranium hexafluoride, the last assessment I saw from IAEA inspectors said that the Iranian-produced uranium hexafluoride, UF6, is incompatible with the centrifuges because it's contaminated with molybdenum. So even though the Iranians want to move on to so-called industrial scale, until they clean up their own indigenous source of uranium hexafluoride, they're limited to the 1,000 tons or the 1,000 kilograms they have from China, and that's not going to take them very far.
Okay, so let's say that they do put in more centrifuges, which is what the deputy nuclear chief of Iran said that they wanted to do, that they want to go from, you said somewhere 164 centrifuges. He says they want to put in 3,000 by the end of this year and then get it up to 54,000 centrifuges. Is that more steps down or up that same ladder, and is that something to worry about?
Well, it's definitely more steps. Remember this, the 164 centrifuges that they put together in this small-scale cascade didn't operate for that long. It did at least one, maybe a couple more to get to 3.7. That 3.7 is not enough. They'd have to run it through again and again and again and again to get it up to 20%, which is usable in nuclear fuel. That's why you have lengthier cascades. For instance, 3,000 centrifuges cascaded will allow you to start a process that'll run it through over a lengthy period of time and at the end give you fuel-grade uranium. But if you wanted weapons-grade, you'd have to run those same centrifuges almost nonstop for a year to punch out the uranium, to punch out weapons-grade uranium. We don't even know if the Iranian centrifuges are capable of sustained operations at this for this period of time. So it's purely hypothetical here. Having said that, the big concern that the United States, Israel, Europe, and everybody has had is once the Iranians have in place this legal system. Remember, nothing we're talking about here is against the law.
Yep.
But once you can enrich uranium to 20%, you have the technical capacity to enrich to weapons grade. And that's always been the argument, that the Iranians can never be allowed to acquire this capability, because if they kicked out inspectors, or you know, if they fooled the inspectors, they won't fool the inspectors. If they kicked out the inspectors, they could theoretically, within a period of months, produce highly enriched uranium. That's the argument. My counter to that is, if they kick out the inspectors, we get to assume the worst, and a couple well-placed bombs terminate any potential, you know, end of story. But you know, that's neither here nor there.
Would you agree that at this point, this is certainly something that we have to monitor?
I've said from day one, I'm not someone out banging the war drums to go and invade Iran. But, and I'm not someone who's saying Iran cannot be allowed to have this technology. I'm someone who believes in nonproliferation, disarmament, and the rule of law. And Iran is a signatory to the NPT. They're allowed to do this, but it has to be heavily monitored. And I'm a proponent of, because the Iranians have not played in good faith early on. Remember, they tried to hide this until 2002. I do believe that Iran needs to be a special case. I do believe that we need to have these additional protocols in there as confidence-building measures. But having said that, I think the United States needs to get off its high horse and stop saying that Iran cannot have an enrichment capability. We need to acknowledge that Iran must be allowed to do that which it is permitted under the treaty, and that the United States needs to insist that Iran adhere to its guarantees that it won't have a nuclear weapons program, and that we put in place an inspection regime that gives us extreme confidence that Iran is abiding in good faith with its obligations.
Scott, can the United Nations Security Council and the International Atomic Energy Agency do that?
The IAEA most certainly can do that. The council is not the right forum. The council is 15 nations, five of them are permanent, who have political strength. The best thing the council could do at this point in time is send the case back to the IAEA and tell the IAEA to ensure that it has stringent monitoring capabilities in place. It's absurd for the council, and this is what the United States wants it to do, for the council to treat Iran as a criminal pariah state when it has not violated any international law, when it is, in fact, operating in full compliance with its obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So the council needs to turn this back to the IAEA. And I will say this, I personally know a lot of the inspectors that are there. These are hardworking, intelligent people. They've learned a lot over the past decades, and they know what they're doing. And if Iran is carrying out a covert nuclear weapons program, they will discover it. And there's no way the Iranians will be able to enrich uranium to weapons-grade level under the nose of these inspectors. We need to let the system work.
Scott, do you have to go, or can you hang on for one more segment?
I can hang on.
Okay, because we've got a couple of calls coming in, and we'll get to those in just a moment here with Scott Ritter on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. Talking with former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter about Iran joining the countries with nuclear technology, according to their president yesterday and their deputy nuclear chief today, saying that they intend to expand uranium enrichment to industrial scale. Let's get to a couple of phone calls here. Cullen, you're on KMOX. Say hi to Scott.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for being here on this program. I really appreciate it. Thank you again, too, Paul. My question is, if they can, advertising that they can enrich uranium to this point and maybe make a nuclear bomb, is this something that they're advertising to insurgents and terrorists that, hey, we may be able to have nuclear material for sale that may be used in like a dirty bomb, for instance? And if you comment on that.
Sure. No, I think the statement is for consumption primarily domestically. It's a statement made by the president of Iran to a domestic audience. You know, Iran is gearing up for a major confrontation with the West over the issue of enrichment, and it's a point of national pride to them that, you know, they be able to, you know, do this technologically. They've invested a tremendous amount of time and resources and money into developing this domestic capability. And I think, we need to recognize that Iran is a technologically advanced nation, a nation that possesses internationally renowned centers of higher learning that are involved in this effort. And this is an issue of pride. I don't think this is the Iranian president telling terrorists and bad people around the world, hey, Iran is now a clearinghouse for nuclear technology. Come one, come all, buy, and let's go to war. No, I think it's the exact opposite. Iran is putting a marker down saying, you can't stop us. You've said you don't want us to have this capability, but the Iranian people won't be stopped. And if you take a look at the ceremony of announcement, there's a lot of national pride involved in this statement. So I believe this is more about, the Iranian president telling his people, look, we have done this, we're on the road, and the West can't stop it. And I think it was also a signal to the West, hey, stop playing games here. We're committed to this path, and you're not going to get us off this path. And remember, the path that he's committed to is, according to him, a path of peaceful nuclear energy, not nuclear weapons.
All right, Cullen, I'm glad you called. Here's Sam, you're on KMOX. Hello.
Thanks. Everyone's been talking about highly enriched uranium, U-235, for use in uranium weapons. But with the lower enrichment, couldn't you synthesize plutonium and equally get to nukes through that route? That's still very scary to me.
No, and it's a good point.
Answer off the air. Thanks.
It's a very good point, and it's one that a lot of people have raised. You know, this whole notion of the Iranians moving towards a uranium weapon. And remember, we're hypothetical here. The Iranians say we don't have a nuclear weapons program, and nobody has been able to provide data that supports that the Iranians are doing anything other than developing this technology, which once they have could enable them to enrich uranium, but is also technology that is used in peaceful nuclear energy. But they do have a heavy water reactor. I don't want to get too technical here, but they have a heavy water reactor where you can reprocess uranium and extract plutonium. And one of the worrying aspects of the Iranian program is that they have admitted to the International Atomic Energy Agency that they did extract an extremely small amount of plutonium through experiments. And the question was, why would you do this? Why would you want to extract plutonium if you didn't have, you know, designs, you know, down the road for a plutonium-based weapons? The Iranians came up with an excuse about, you know, the medical isotopes, things of that nature, which on the surface are plausible, but again, it's something where a big question mark exists. But keep in mind that the IAEA inspectors are on the job, and they're all over this, and it's not something the Iranians would be able to do without being detected.
So to sum up here, we absolutely have to keep monitoring what's going on over there, but it is way, way, way too early to push the panic button.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm all over monitoring, and I'm someone who says that if the Iranians at this point in time, for instance, kicked out all the inspectors, that we're allowed to assume the worst.
Yep.
But as long as the Iranians are allowing inspectors in, and I would push for additional protocol inspections. I would say, look, you haven't been playing this game in good faith. Yes, I understand complicated history, United States and sanctions, et cetera. But be that as it may, that Iran needs to do more to make the international community comfortable with this program. But, you know, we aren't even close to the panic button yet. Even if Iran kicked out inspectors today and moved down this path, they're years away from having a nuclear weapon.
Scott, you've been my go-to guy on this sort of thing for years, and I always appreciate your expertise. Thanks for coming on again today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter here on the Paul Harris Show, exclusively on News Talk 1120 KMOX.